our deputy clerk to call the case.
Court call TPHR new business center here in Knoxville, Benton versus the Wendy Kaufman. May it please the court, the president will be for argument of the appellant, and Mr. Billy McGill will argue for the applicant.
Okay, Ms. Forkey, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Heather Forkey, and I represent TTHR LP DBA Presbyterian Hospital of Denton, who I'll refer to as Presby Denton, just for the sake of not repeating myself. This is a case, Your Honors, involving a hospital's alleged wrongful disclosure of a patient's confidential health information. The issue before the court is whether this is a healthcare liability claim within the meaning of Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Chapter 74, such that the expert report requirement would apply to the case. The carrot issue occurred when Ms. Amanda Kaufman, the appellee, was brought via ambulance to Presby Denton's emergency department. She was complaining of possibly being drugged at a party on the UNT campus, I believe. A urine test revealed the presence of various illegal drugs in her body. Now, according to Ms. Kaufman, this information was allegedly wrongfully disclosed to the UNT Police Department, and she was subsequently dismissed from the university and from university housing. Now, there's two main points I want to focus on as to why this is a healthcare liability claim within the meaning of the definition provided in the code. No, Your Honor, we're not denying that it's disclosed. The reason I was using the word alleged is because the facts aren't at issue here, as Your Honor is aware, just the issue of law as to whether the definition covers what she alleges. Okay. We are, however, not conceding that it was improper in any way. That's an issue not before the court today, but just for the sake of argument, we're not conceding that. The first reason why this is a healthcare liability claim is simply the plain language of the definition in Chapter 74. And the second point I want to focus on is the case law that analyzes whether claims like this fall under that definition. So first, the plain language definition. At CPRC 74001A13, the legislature defines a healthcare liability claim. Now, as the court is certainly aware, the definition is a mouthful, so I'll take it by the elements. Obviously, it's a cause of action. Nobody's disputing that it's against a healthcare provider, Presbyterian Hospital of Denton. The third element is that it is for treatment, lack of treatment, or other claimed departure from accepted standards of medical care or health care or safety or professional or administrative services directly related to health care. Now, elsewhere in that provision, the term health care is also defined, and that is defined as any act or treatment performed or furnished or that should have been performed and furnished by any health care provider for, to, or on behalf of a patient, and it goes on a little ways, but that's the relevant part. Now, I submit to the court that keeping a chart relating to Ms. Kaufman's treatment, complying with HIPAA and other confidentiality requirements that they have cited in their petition and in their briefing, is an act or treatment furnished or that should have been furnished by Presbyterian Hospital of Denton in connection with Ms. Kaufman's health care. So clearly, if keeping a chart and keeping it confidential is health care, which it is under the health care definition, then claiming a departure from accepted standards of that care falls under the definition.
How about releasing it to the wastewater?
What does that involve, a claim departure from? Well, yes, Your Honor, because the HIPAA requires confidentiality. We're all familiar with that. The health and safety code, the Texas Health and Safety Code, in requiring a hospital to be licensed, in setting forth the what a hospital is required to do to be licensed, requires them to set forth a patient bill of rights, which they've also attached to their briefing in this case. Those things go hand in hand with health care, with providing health care. They would not have done those things. They would not have created a chart if they were not rendering health care. It's inextricably intertwined with health care. Now,
are they going to have to put on expert testimony in a trial with respect to Presbyterian Hospital's liability?
Yes, Your Honor.
Actions?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that they will. They are going. They've pled negligence, and they've also pled a violation of the Texas Health and Safety Code. Now, leaving aside the issue of whether, as I said before, leaving aside the issue of whether those are proper causes of action against the hospital or not, to prove a breach of confidentiality, they are going to have to put on expert testimony that shows that the hospital had a duty to maintain the confidentiality and that the hospital's alleged failure to maintain that confidentiality did not fall within any of the exceptions to confidentiality, which are replete through the code. And that actually gets to the Murphy versus Russell case, which I will also discuss. In Murphy, the Texas Supreme Court, no less, said that even if expert testimony is not required, it doesn't matter. It won't be required ultimately to prevail does not mean that an expert report is not required at this stage. And that also brings me to the Administrative Services Amendment found in the definition of healthcare liability claim.
When was that added?
I believe it was 2003. The prior version of the definition did not include the language professional or administrative services. Now, what is a professional or administrative service? Well, thankfully, the legislature did define that for us. And they define that at 74001A24 as those duties or services that a healthcare provider is required to provide as a condition of maintaining the healthcare provider's license, accreditation, or certification to participate in state or federal healthcare programs. Now, certainly it goes without saying again that a hospital is required to keep a chart regarding each patient's care and is required to follow basic rules regarding confidentiality of those records, and that those duties go hand in hand with its maintaining its license to practice in the state as a hospital. Now, there's been a lot of briefing on statutory construction, and I would just point out that the legislature chose to broaden that definition, and its broadening of that definition must be given effect. So the hospital submits that even without that amendment, the allegations relate to a claimed departure from a standard of health care. But even more so with that addition of the professional or administrative services, they broadened the scope to include cases like this.
Ms. Harvard, on each of the definitions you've read to us, both the definition of health care liability claim and the definition of health care liability within the part of the 74001A 13, each time when you've read those, you've left off the following words, which includes which possibly results in injury to or death of a claimant.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be unclear. I was addressing each section of the definition in sequence, and that was actually my next point, the final element.
What do you think about that?
I'm sorry. That was unclear. Well, I take it that what Your Honor is getting at is plaintiff's argument, or appellee's argument, excuse me, that there should be a physical injury requirement. Well, plain and simple, what they're asking the court to do is to add a word to the definition that the legislature did not put in the definition. I would also point out that in the DiversaCare versus Rubio case cited in our briefing, in the hospital's briefing, the Texas Supreme Court explicitly says we're not to focus on the injury at issue here in determining whether this definition of healthcare liability claim applies. In DiversaCare, the plaintiff was a nursing home resident who was sexually assaulted by another patient. She sued the nursing home, and she argued that this is not a healthcare liability claim. The requirements of Chapter 74, I believe it was 4590I at the time, those do not apply to me because this is not about medical malpractice in any way. Well, the court disagreed and said, we focus on the essence of plaintiff's claim and consider the alleged wrongful conduct and the duties allegedly breached rather than the unfortunate injuries she suffered. So we have the Texas Supreme Court saying, we're looking at the conduct, the bad conduct that they're alleging, not the alleged result. Also, there are other cases. No, Your Honor. She claims that she was injured in that she was expelled from school and from student housing. There's no definition of injury in the statute, and therefore asking to add in the word physical, you can be injured financially, emotionally, in many different ways. And in fact, I was just about to go through a couple of cases where cases claiming non-physical injuries were found to be healthcare liability claims. For example, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
First, the Buck v. Blum case, not sure which it is, involved an alleged sexual assault by a physician. Now, the facts are just awful, but this was a neurologist who allegedly, in trying to determine whether a patient's hand injury was whether she had hand strength, asked her to put her hands behind her back and then inserted his penis into her hands. Now, she sued, and she argued the exact same thing. This has nothing to do with health care. This is a sexual assault. The court said the proper province of what a doctor should do during an exam is a healthcare liability claim because it involves an alleged departure of the standard of care. So there was no physical injury to her. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to argue that she was not emotionally injured by that, but there was no physical injury to her, and they ruled it was a healthcare liability claim. Same thing with Grooms versus USH of Timberlawn, also cited in our brief. The minor plaintiff had been stopped while driving without a license, and he had made some comments about possibly wanting to commit suicide. He's later committed, and the plaintiff parent asked the defendant hospital, not asked, instructed them, I want him discharged, and I don't want him to have any medications administered to him. They refused to discharge him, and they, in fact, administered medications against her will, the parents' will. There was no physical injury. In fact, there was an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim and a false imprisonment claim and an abusive process claim. Those claims were held to be health care liability claims. No physical injury. Yes, Your Honor, and that was my final point after the cases, actually. Plaintiff's petition includes a claim for physical pain and loss of sleep. Now, she may argue that she's asserted those in her petition under the cause of action against UNT, who has been dismissed under jurisdictional grounds, but I would argue that this is a fair notice pleading state. She's pled those as a result of the exact same allegedly wrongful disclosure. So she has pled those.
While we're on that subject, just submit to you a hypothet. Suppose she just lost her job. Suppose that was all she was alleging, financial loss. Would that still be a health liability claim?
Yes.
Under the statute is amended?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would. Because as the Texas Supreme Court said in the DiversiCare v. Rubio case, we don't look at the injury she suffered. We look at the underlying nature of the claim, which was, I see I'm out of time, but my second point was going to be. Yes, I believe it was, Your Honor. And so that actually strengthens my argument because not only was that a health care liability claim at that time, it's even if you don't buy that this was a health care liability claim under that prior definition, now that they've expanded the scope, it would be. I see I'm out of time. I will raise any other points in my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel. Billy McGill here on behalf of the appellee, Amanda Kaufman. This is a statutory construction case, and I'm going to talk about some of the applicable statutory construction rules in just a second. And the statutory construction questions are, and I think that the appellant is trying to read injury out of the statute in making her argument, and I think the loss of the job is a good hypothetical. Is getting kicked out of school an injury that is directly related to the rendition of health care services? That's one question. The other question is, does the Medical Liability Act, under the facts of this case, require an expert report? And I think if you look at both of those questions and the rules of statutory construction, the only conclusion you can reach is that this is not a health care liability claim and was not subject to the expert report requirement. Now, we've talked about the Texas Code Construction Act in our brief, and there are some factors that are listed there that that court should consider in determining what a statute means. Some of those that are applicable are the object sought to be obtained by the statute, the circumstances under which the statute was created, the consequences of a particular construction. Now, if you look at the statute and look at the purpose of the statute, it gives you guidance, and the Texas Supreme Court in the Marks case that's talked about in the brief, it does give you guidance as to what the statute means. Now, if you read the statutory notes to section 74.001, it goes into the reasons why the statute was enacted. And it was enacted because of a crisis in medical malpractice insurance, that medical malpractice was getting too expensive, doctors couldn't afford it, they passed on the additional cost to their patients, and so the legislature decided it needed to do something about the medical malpractice crisis. So you have to read the statute in light of the purpose that it was enacted. And that is what the Texas Supreme Court in the Marks case pointed out. The Marks case came out in August of 2010. And I want to look at that for a second. Now, the Marks case was a case that arose under the safety. Was this a safety claim under the Health Care Liability Act? In that case, a patient had fallen out of a defective hospital bed and become injured, and the court was considering, is this a health care liability claim? Now, the court ultimately decided in that case that it was a health care liability claim, but the significance of Marks to us in this case is how the court analyzed that issue and what it considered in construing a statute. Now, it first said you have to consider the term safety in the context of the statute. The court said the legislature could not have intended that standards of safety encompass all negligent injuries to patients. Such a broad interpretation of the safety standard would render the statute's more specific standards of medical and health care unnecessary. And we do not read statutory language to be pointless if it is reasonably susceptible to another construction. Moreover, given the object of the statute and the legislature's expressed concern, it is apparent that the legislature did not intend for standards of safety to extend to every negligent injury that might befall a patient. Applying the principle of justum generis, we conclude that standards of safety must be construed in light of other standards of medical and health care, standards that are directly related to the patient's care and treatment. So in order for a claim to be a health care liability claim under Marks, it must be directly related to the patient's health care and medical treatment. You know, keeping records is part of the rendering of services. But turning over records to a patient's school without the patient's permission has nothing to do with rendering health care to the patient. And the injury that you sustain by the information being turned over to your school or to your job, the injury you sustain by that, loss of income, whatever injuries flow from that, have nothing to do with the rendition treatment directly related to standards of medical care. It has nothing to do with malpractice insurance or malpractice rates, which you have to read the statute in that light.
So you want us to read in the word physical, even though it's not there.
Your Honor, I think that is, if you look at rules of statutory construction, that is a reasonable interpretation of the statute. What injury cannot mean under rules of statutory construction is simply civil damages, because the statute uses the term, the very statute uses the term damages in other sections, but it didn't use damages here. It used the term injury.
And the court, she
was injured by the release. She was injured because she was suspended. Her injury was the suspension from school because the hospital released this information. That injury is not directly related to the rendition of health care services. Well, I think you could assert that a doctor's failure to perform the surgery that you ask him to perform, if he fails to perform the surgery in the manner that he was asked, that could be both a tort and a contract claim. So I don't think characterizing it as a contract or a tort claim makes any difference in this case. But we are asserting, we're not asserting a contract claim. We're asserting a statutory violation. The other issue that you have to grapple with in this case is, what are the consequences of a particular construction? Another way to phrase that is, will the statutory construction that you're being asked to render lead to absurd results. And I think in looking at it that way, the court should consider if we construe the statute this way, you know, what are we telling lawyers in the future that they are going to have to do in these kinds of cases? So assume that I'm a lawyer in some future case, and I have a case where my client gets fired because his doctor turns over private medical information to his employer. So I'm a lawyer, and I'm reading a court opinion that says, yes, in this case, turning over your private medical information, if it gets you fired, that's a health care liability claim. So I ask myself, okay, if I have to do that, what do I need in an expert report? I need the expert report to say that the doctor violated the privacy statute, section 159.002. I have to get an expert to talk about whether any of the 14 exceptions to the privacy statute apply. And I actually have to have an expert opine in the report about whether or not this action caused my client's termination. Now, who is qualified to render an opinion about whether particular conduct violated this statute or whether any of these 14 or so exceptions apply? If you look at the exceptions, one is if a patient is attempting to recover monetary damages for a physical or mental condition. One of the exceptions is in an involuntary civil commitment proceeding, proceeding for court-ordered treatment or probable cause hearing under chapters 462, 574, or 593. One of the exceptions is if a patient's physical or medical condition is relevant to the execution of a will. One of the exceptions is to a court or party in an action under a court order or court subpoena. So I'm asking myself, what kind of expert can give me an opinion about whether any of these exceptions to the privacy statute apply? Because I have to have an expert address those in my expert report. And I'm thinking, I would need a lawyer or a retired judge to address these issues. But then I look at the statute. In this case, the deviation of the standard of care is whether or not the doctor violated the specific terms of the statute. And you have to look at not only the disclosure, but whether an exception applies to determine whether the doctor violated the standard of care. So you have to look at these exceptions and get an opinion about these exceptions to determine initially whether there was a violation of the standard of care. And I'm thinking, when I look at this, I need a lawyer to give me an opinion about that. But I read the statute, and the expert that writes the report has to be a health care provider practicing in the same or a similar field. And I think, well, okay, a lawyer can't do this. A doctor can't do this because a doctor doesn't have the legal expertise to read these exceptions and figure out what they mean. They have to do that, Your Honor, but they're not experts in it. A hospital administrator wouldn't be an expert on these very complex exceptions to the statute. And a hospital administrator couldn't be an expert because a hospital administrator is not a physician practicing in the same field.
It doesn't say that in the statute. Under one of those, I don't have it in front of me, but under one of the provisions as to who can provide the expert report, it says
You know, I did attach the expert qualifications statute to the brief, and it does talk about the qualifications of an expert. And it says, Section 74.402B, that the expert must be practicing health care in a field of practice that involves the same type of care or treatment that is delivered by the defendant. That's 74.402. So I submit that an expert report under the statutory definition must be written by a doctor. And I submit that you can't find a doctor that can give you an opinion about these exceptions. And the point is that reading the statute to require an expert report in this kind of case leads to an absurd result where I would have to find a lawyer who can construe these statutory provisions, who is also a doctor practicing in the same field. And I also have to have causation in my expert report. So I have to have an expert render an opinion in the report that says my client's damages were caused, my client's termination from his job was caused by the disclosure of this medical information. Now, what does a doctor know about employment practices, about employment terminations? Doctor's not an expert on that. If anything, a human resources person would be the kind of person I would need.
Gil, I know your time's up. Okay. I want to ask you a question. If the judge will allow me to ask a question after the time's expired.
Oh, yes.
I looked with interest on your argument that the Sloan case should not apply in this circumstance.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I read your brief, you're basically asserting that the language in the Sloan case, just before the paragraph that is titled Paragraph 3, Conclusions, takes the position that the Dallas court, in writing this language, that the farmers respond that the claim cannot be considered an administrative service because it does not involve physical injury or death. And then the next sentence, the court said, because we have determined that the claim breach of confidentiality involves a departure from accepted standards of medical health care and is inseparable from the rendition of health care services, we need not decide whether the claim further comports with the definition of a health care liability claim. Now, do you read that to say that this court in the Sloan case simply wasn't considering whether or not the phraseology in the definition of a health care claim about involving injury or death is what the focus of the court.
The court specifically said we're not considering whether there was an injury or death. And I think you have to, because that's specifically in the definition of a health care liability case. You have to consider that issue to determine whether the statute even applies.
You're drawing the distinction that in terms of the Supreme Court's suggestion that you are to look at this statute in terms of delivery of health care doesn't apply to a claim under 159.002 and 009 that allows a recovery of civil damages if the disclosure causes civil damages to the patient.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, just a few points in rebuttal. Again, the Texas Supreme Court has said we don't focus on the injury. We focus on what the health care provider allegedly did. Now, if you look at our briefing, you'll see various cases on DTPA claims. And some of those cases were ruled healthcare liability claims, and some were not. The distinction between whether they were healthcare liability claims was whether the underlying conduct of the healthcare provider implicated healthcare, whether it was inextricably intertwined with health care, whether the allegations involved an allegation of a departure from the standard of care applicable to health care providers. So I submit to you here that wrongfully disclosing someone's medical records is inextricably intertwined with health care. They wouldn't have been recording apart from providing health care, the hospital would not have been charting about this patient.
I understand the argument that you're making to be that the fact that you keep records is required by health care.
Yes.
And then the fact that you keep the records to provide the health care, if you then subsequently violate a second statute that doesn't relate to a health care claim, that you carry over the fact that you had to keep records in order to provide health care, to be that if you go to sue for civil damages under the occupation code, that you still have to go in and provide for an expert report under the health care law.
What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is that we don't look at what she suffered. We look at what they did.
But we look at now, what the pleadings say instead of what she suffered, even if the pleadings are seeking to recover civil damages for wrongful disclosure under the occupation code, then isn't that not? I mean, I don't see how that becomes a health care claim, just because you got to keep records in order to provide health care.
Your Honor, actually, the Texas Supreme Court has said that we are not bound by the plaintiff's pleadings. They're not permitted to recast their claims and fit them into causes of action to avoid what commonly sound to us lawyers like healthcare liability claims. We look at the underlying nature.
Your position that the occupation code provision is a medical malpractice matter.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Is it your position that a violation of section 159.002 and 159.009 of the occupation code is a healthcare claim, period?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. Because
I understand your argument.
And further, regarding the exceptions to confidentiality, again, while the facts are not before the court, what will be at issue in this case, should it proceed, is the issue of waiver, and is the issue of whether a verbal waiver was enough. Now, to Justice Gabriel's point regarding regarding what experts are qualified, yes, an expert, section 74.351R5 defines expert. And if you look at subsection B, with respect to a person giving opinion testimony regarding whether a health care provider departed from accepted standards of health care, an expert is qualified, or expert means an expert qualified to testify under the requirements of section 74.402. So they kick us to another statute or another code provision. So we head over to 402, and it says, in a suit involving a health care liability claim against a health care provider, a person may qualify as an expert witness on the issue of whether the health care provider departed from accepted standards of care only if the person, and it goes through three lengthy requirements, none of which say anything about it being a physician. So to Your Honor's point, yes, it could be a hospital administrator. It could be someone familiar with creating the code of patient's bill of rights. Excuse me. It could be someone high up in the hospital, as Your Honor suggested. And I would also point out, as a caveat to the arguments about experts, that expert testimony does not have to be required for it to be found to be a healthcare liability claim. Thank you.
They have to file an expert report. That's the whole point.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. What I meant to say was under Murphy v. Russell, the expert testimony does not have to be required at trial for there to be the requirement of an expert report after 120 days. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for excellent briefs and excellent arguments. We appreciate it. Your case is submitted.